Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. It's Monday, April 30th, 2007. At this time, we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 37.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Deckard.
I move Senate Bill 37 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Any questions or comments? Any objection?
No.
Okay. You want to take a vote on this, right? Okay, the clerk will call the roll. Or do you want to just move it that way?
Excuse.
Aye.
Senator Monroe.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Excuse.
Senator Deckard.
Aye.
Okay. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 37, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill
959.
We're going to exchange you and bring you back.
Wait.
All right.
Thanks, Chair. Come on, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 959 amends ORS 308.290, which pertains to property tax returns that must be filed by owners of industrial property. Current law states that any person, managing officer of any firm, corporation, or association owning real or personal property in Oregon must file a return with the assessor of the county in which the property is located. There may be some confusion about the taxpayer in this case, because this bill would clarify who must file a tax return by adding the word business to the list provided under current law. It would permit a taxpayer who has not filed a personal and real property tax return to file an application for relief of tax penalties with the county assessor in which the property is located. It grants the county assessors the discretion, however, to grant or deny the applications for tax relief. It also requires the Secretary of State to provide applicants for assumed business names with certain tax information, and it takes effect upon becoming law.
Okay, we have three folks signed up on Senate Bill 959, and that's Susan Gill and John. If the three of you would come on up if you're here. They must have thought we would be a little later.
Senator Johnson.
We'll stand, and Senator Johnson was here too.
Here it comes.
All right.
Okay.
Come right on up, you guys. We've already called for you. Didn't realize you were outside.
I'm sorry. I have never done this before, so
oh, yeah.
I'm not sure what the procedure is. I did bring some written testimony. Who do I give that to?
We went out of order, so it's not your fault here. Hand it right over there.
Okay. My name is Susan Oliker, for the record.
Okay. Thanks, Susan.
I'm here representing my husband, who has a hardwood floor business, Stephens Hardwood Floors, and also representing all small property business owners that need to pay personal property tax. My husband has been in business for over 15 years, and 2 years ago we received notice that we were supposed to pay personal property tax for his business. We had no idea what this meant, but we filled out the forms and we turned them in. And when the information came back, it turned out that we were supposed to pay for 4 years of back taxes plus 100% penalties on two of those years and 50% penalties on the other 2 years. We were amazed at this. So I went about searching out why we didn't know about this law, because we are type of people that pay our taxes on time and support government and vote for all of the taxes that come about. We believe we're happy to be living in America. Through searching out the information, we found that there really wasn't any set way that they were letting people know about this tax. And our assessor has been an assessor in our county for over 20 years. And by his own admission, he said that he had only put it in the newspaper maybe twice. And So this was the first time we had received this form saying that we had to pay these taxes. I then called the Department of Revenue and talked to John Phillips and to other members of the Revenue Department. And again, it was very unclear as to, first of all, when the tax came into being. I never did get that answered, although property taxes in general have been in being for well over 100 years. It was not clear what means they were using, if any, to let property to let people know about this tax 15 years ago. Because what was cited to me was that they were putting the information on the Internet. Well, the computers weren't in being, especially for personal use, 15 years ago. And also, they had a booklet out, and no one could tell me how many years ago that booklet was first produced. As clear as I could get, maybe 5 years ago. So again, we're back to what happened 15 years ago to let people know that this tax existed. I did a survey of other assessors in the state. I called about 16 different assessors, and there was no set procedure that assessors used to let people know about this tax. So my contention is that we need to have, if this tax is important source of revenue for the state, then we need to have a set procedure that makes it so that everyone that is responsible to pay for this tax is taxed, not the few people that, quote unquote, they suddenly figure out that they've got a business and then they send out the notices and then you pay the penalties and then you're kind of used as an example as to why people should go in and find out about this tax. When I talk, we've always had advertisements in the paper for our business. We've had our name in the phone book up to the last couple of years. We've always gone to a professional tax preparer, and they knew nothing about this tax. So it's like, wait a minute. If you're supposed to trust government and you're supposed to work with government, you've got to make it so that the people can do that. And that's why I am for amending this law. So that, number one, it gives more clear language as to who is supposed to be paying the tax. That was part of what I saw is when I read through this whole thing, I couldn't tell that small business was supposed to pay it. And also, when I read through it, there were different areas where, for instance, it appeared that if the assessor didn't send out notice, that you weren't responsible. But when I asked the assessor about it, he said, no, that doesn't apply to you. That applies to such and such and such and such. I also found out that with the exception of small business, other areas that are supposed to pay this personal property tax have no penalties if they don't pay the back taxes. So why is a small business being penalized? That doesn't make sense to me either. I had written notes in order, and I haven't used them at all. I didn't get a chance to help pin this. The background information that I just handed was the letter that I had sent to Betsy Johnson and also to John Phillips and to Tim Lutz when I first came upon this problem and researched it. I'm hoping that you will read through the information and see that this law does need to be tweaked. I'm not complaining about the law. I'm complaining about the process in which the law is being delivered right now. The fact that the Department of Revenue has a booklet that our assessor never even knew about, that took quite a few days of calling different individuals to find out what's available, calling revenue people, not John Phillips, but a couple of other people that worked at the Revenue Department, them telling me to go to another branch of the Revenue Department, and that branch no longer existed for 2 years. So how is Joe Public supposed to know that if the people that work here in the Revenue Department don't even know it? And even though it's on the website, I was just going back to the website to pull up my bill, the one that we pinned here, and it took me, even though I had been through it once, it again took me several hours to find it again, because it's hard to access and to really navigate that whole website unless you're really computer savvy. So somehow information needs to get from the Revenue Department all the way through the people that work for the Revenue Department down to their assessors and then to the people that have to pay it. And because this hasn't happened, there needs to be an, what I call an amnesty period, where the people that haven't been noticed, given notice of this bill, don't have to pay a penalty until they get on board. And somehow, the assessor's office and the state revenue office need to have a set procedure that is going to educate the public, because we aren't born with this information. We aren't given this information in school. It has to be educated to us somehow. I used to be a teacher, so you can tell that. So in this law, the amendments that we're asking for, it's changing the language so that it says businesses, which wasn't clear before. It is saying that the State Department will provide applicants for assumed business names information, which is a way of, everyone has to apply for assumed business names. So if they do that in the right way, if they provide that booklet to the assumed business department so that when they send out the application for their name, they include the booklet and maybe even a little piece of paper that says, personal property tax applies to you, then that could solve the problem. And also, if they put it on a line item, which isn't in this little amendment right here, if it could be tweaked further for the next level, if they put it in the state proper, or the state revenue tax form as a line item with an explanation, then accountants and people that are doing their own taxes would say, hey, what's this all about? I better go check. It would at least give them a way of spurring their mind on to finding out what it's about. So I urge you to pass this on and make it clearer. Thank you.
Any questions for Susan? Susan, would you state your last name again?
A-A-L-Y-K-K-E.
No, I see
you spell
it.
Oliker.
Yeah. Sorry, boy, I was about to say it incorrectly.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted to mention about tweaking it is they put in a filing fee here, a late filing fee to ask for, if you want to not have the penalties applied to you, they want to make you have to pay to put in, to have that done. And I don't think that's fair at this point because, again, they haven't done any educating of the public. So for the first period of time when they get everyone on board, it shouldn't cost them to file for an appeal. After they've done education, which this is the first year that the revenue department did put something in the newspaper and our assessors did put something in the newspaper for 2 years and or 2 weeks in a row. This is basically the first time that they have done that in 12 years.
John, would you like to go ahead and address the questions? And I think that's a legitimate. Betsy, did you? I indicated you might want to come up. Would you want to come and speak? Or?
No, Mr. Chair. I was just here in support of my constituent who brought this problem to my attention and on whose behalf I filed the bill.
And pardon me, I said Betsy, and it's Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue. Yes, I had the chance to meet Ms. Oliker, Susan Oliker, last summer, I believe, when this came up and chatted with her county assessor several times about it. I think the assessor was very amenable to working something out, and we researched it, and there does seem to be an issue. There was a bill passed in 2003 that allowed first-time filers to have their penalty waived. And that the concept there was that if you're a first-time filer and that if you've never had a responsibility to file in Oregon before, then, you know, the penalty can and should be waived. It's up to the Board of Property Tax Appeals to make that decision. The issue in this situation was that the 5 years, as soon as the assessor discovered the property had not been reported on a return for the business, then the assessor can go back, by law, 5 years, Not the full length of the property had been in existence or taxable, but only the past 5 years. And then apparently, unbeknownst to a lot of people, that even though the first year can be waived, the second, third, fourth, and fifth couldn't. So this is the situation we had. The assessor, like I said, was very amenable to just waiving it. Asked us, we said we thought the law required the penalty to be imposed without a discretion, that we were open to having that changed. He brought it to the, that's Tim Lutz, assessor for Tillamook County. He brought it to the Assessors Association, and they didn't really coalesce around any particular legislative solution, and Susan had indicated she was pursuing one through Senator Johnson, so that's the way it went. The case went to the magistrate. The assessor really thought that the magistrate could waive it. The magistrate decided they couldn't. They had no authority to waive it. And so there were some situations that occurred in terms of the value being underneath the threshold. There's a cancellation threshold beneath which the value doesn't rise above that threshold. There is no tax anyway. In this case, that's what happened. So I think the situation was resolved, but Susan was very adamant that the procedure be corrected for other people who found themselves in a similar situation, and that's great. We looked at it internally as being supervisors of the property tax system. The counties actually implement the system, but since we oversee it and supervise it, we tried to look at what we could do to alleviate the situation. We determined that at the bare minimum, we should improve our link in our website for businesses that go to our website for general corporate or personal income taxes. If they see business, they can hit that link and get to information on property taxes. So we did that. Then we thought that a couple of news releases might be a good idea. We sent one in November and one in February. And we chose November because that's when we send the information out to, that's when property tax statements are due. And then the one in February is when we're expecting the returns to be coming back in. And if you get one of these, if you see the release and you say, well, I didn't file a return, maybe it would click with you. And we thought that was a good timing. So we committed to issue two releases a year. And then we did look at this book, which is called How to Start a Business in Oregon, published by the Secretary of States. They said that they had not had, as I recall, the funding to continue handing it out to every small business. So they do have a blurb little in the booklet about property taxes for small businesses. So I think that's what the last section of the bill refers to. In terms of the Secretary of State providing that information. Susan mentioned a couple of key points of the bill itself. It deals with, on page 4, it allows, on line 27, the assessor to waive. And in this case, I know the assessor, had the authority, would have waived it on his own authority under this statute. We already have, like I said, a first-time filer, first-year issue, so this will take the other 4 years into consideration. And in terms of the dollar amount, I'd like to just say one comment about that. We had no influence in the drafting of the legislation, but now that I see it, it has a blank. It does seem a little odd to me without a lot of analysis from staff, but at this point, I'm not sure why we would have a fee to file for a waiver of fees. It seems a little bit... personally, I don't understand it. So, I'm a bureaucrat, and I should understand it, but I don't. So I'm not recommending any dollars out there.
That's correct.
If I can answer any questions, I'd be happy to.
Any questions? John, I do have a question. We were almost caught in two of these, and it was just by luck and by good work of an accountant that they picked up on it and warned us. And I can see how this can happen. I mean, you go in and you change the name of one entity to another, and all of a sudden you're subject to tax that you weren't before. And we had been, on one of them, we'd been buying fuel in a certain way, and we switched to another way. And the question was, had the tax been paid to ODOT? And so all of a sudden, you know, you can see that you could fall into harm's way very, very quickly because, you know, not only the amount that you owe, but also the penalties and interest that might accrue on that.
Right.
So it seems like a very reasonable procedure. Now, if the committee drafted amendments to eliminate the fee for the fee, so your group would be fine, happy with that, or acceptable to you guys.
Mr. Chair, yes. And there's been almost every session discussion about omitted property. And when property is discovered, you know, the theory is that everybody that has property subject to taxation should be paying. And to the extent that they're not, is it fair to everyone else? So the system really works if it's fair and everybody's paying their fair share. There is obviously recognition that people either don't know about the obligation for whatever reason, and that's you know, that's one of the reasons why there's only a 5-year look back. The law, you know, I've looked at it for years, and it doesn't appear that there's anything in the statutes about intentionality. Did someone intentionally try to avoid the law? Was it a mistake? And at the same time, the assessor or the tax collector can make a mistake. And there's no evaluation of intent. And so, you know, that's probably a very good thing, because then we don't get into a court situation. We just say it's due for 5 years. You owed it. It was fair. You know, the problem here is the penalty appropriate, especially if it was the situation was not known. I think for the assessors, it's, you know, maybe it's never going to be a problem. It does say they may waive. It doesn't provide any criteria. You know, in this case, Tim, the assessor, would have waived the penalties had he had the authority. I don't know if that's going to be the case. We have 36 assessors in the department. You know, doesn't have absolute say over the assessors, and this gives them the latitude, and that's fine with us. But just so you know.
Maybe I should insert something here. Gil Riddell, Association of Warren Counties. The assessors have no trouble with this at all. This bill is fine. In terms of the blank dollar amount, if you took that out, that would be fine too. I ought to take this opportunity, though, to put in a plug for if you had a fully funded assessment taxation system with staffing who could do this kind of education, then we would be a little more helpful, I think, in these situations. But we work with what we have. So that's sometimes there's a fall off, and this is one of those unfortunate situations.
Any questions for Gil?
Mr. Chair, now, when this comes back for work session, we do need an amendment on page 5 that deletes, and line 30 deletes with a late filing fee of blank.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And also on page 4. Line 16.
You're right. It's in there twice.
Mr. Chair, if I might, the reason why it's in there twice is because one of these statutes amends the filing requirements for real and combined returns. Combined is real and personal for entities that have those. And the other one is the second one on page 5 is for entities that just have personal property. So they're really the same provisions. It's just different types of property that are being addressed. So that's why it's in twice.
Okay.
Can I say one more thing? And we were just talking about when you work on it in committee. Again, I think it's important that maybe a little bit more language change needs to take place in terms of education of the public, because that's on the last page, page 6, would it be? Page 6, right. And it's saying that that the applicant should determine or consult with an attorney or an accountant to assist the applicants in determining tax obligations. Well, again, the accountants and the attorneys need to know about this law, too. And the way it's written here, it's not saying that they have to know about it. It's just saying that you're supposed to check with them on it. And we had been going to an accountant, and they didn't know about it. So that's why that booklet, maybe if that's the point, they need to do it where they need to fund that booklet and send it to all those people that need to let the public know about it.
Okay. Any further questions? Senator Monroe.
Susan, I would recommend that you work with Senator Johnson and in terms of additional amendment that may need in the language of that and so on, so that we would have it then available when this bill goes to work session. And I'd just like to say that your testimony was among the most cogent I've ever heard for a first-timer here. And, of course, that's because you're a former teacher. I'm a former teacher. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for everyone for taking your time on this, and for Betsy Johnson for allowing me to work with her on this, and for John Phillips and our assessor.
All right. Thank you. Senator Johnson, then we'll look forward to you guys developing the amendments. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. With that, if I don't see any further testimony, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 959. And we'll open up a public hearing, possible work session on Senate Bill 827A.
Is it 27?
Irving Glick Foundry.
Well, we could get rid of 820.
Okay, wait, stand by. I'm going to close the public hearing and possible work session on 827A, and we're going to open up a public hearing and possible work session on 820.
820, yeah. I think they need these three right back there.
Put that in your pile again.
Try to be careful what I tell you.
I'm going to have to get something to do. Oops. Now, despite our pitiful voices, you got, we are on 820.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Burrows, representing Central Lincoln, Northern Wasco, and Columbia River People's Utility Districts. I have the Dash 1 amendments here, which were requested by the rural electrical co-ops. We're fine with those, but I believe they won't be necessary if the Dash 2s, which Mr. McCarthy is going to bring forward, are adopted, because they're included in the Dash 2s as well. I'm going to pass off to Mr. Goddard to talk about the specifics of the bill.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Don Goddard and represent the six PUDs in the state of Oregon. The purpose of this bill is to facilitate PUDs acquiring renewable resources. And the reason we need to be here, as opposed to all the other forms of electric utilities, is that we're very closely prescribed by ORS 261. We only have the authorities the legislature grants. And a lot has changed since those were last reviewed. And so we're asking for amendments that allow us to go acquire renewable resources in today's world. And the big change there is the federal government has a very important production tax credit for renewable resources. It's only available to those entities that have income tax liability. PUDs pay property tax, but not income tax. And so for us to capture the benefit of that, we have to work with private entities who do have that tax liability. And so these provisions allow us to do acquire resources in partnership with private entities as well as other forms of utilities. And the other big change is it allows us to use what's called the Uniform Revenue Bond Act and ORS 288. Presently, we're the only public body that doesn't have that authority. We recognize that our proposals here won't have any legs if they interfere with other forms of utilities. So we support the change asked for by the co-ops and the change that's asked for by PGE that's in the Dash 2 amendments. Thank you.
And good morning, members of the committee. Brendan McCarthy with Portland General Electric. I want to thank both these gentlemen for allowing PGE to piggyback on to their bill and get a few minor changes to their language. Generally speaking, PGE has a long history with PUDs and not always in the most cooperative environment. And so there's a special concern in PGE's heart when things look a little bit like expanding condemnation authority. So there's a small change in Section 5 that would ensure that the partnering with cooperatives or LLCs did not also carry with it a broader the broad condemnation authority for distribution assets, which PGE is concerned about. And the other change is in the actual issuance of the uniform revenue bonds to ensure that they will be issued just like other revenue bonds that PUDs issue. So that would be in Section 5 and Section 8. And beyond that, we're essentially conforming Senate Bill 820 with Senate Bill 812, which has already moved forward in a different committee. So these are, in a sense, their conforming amendments.
So my understanding was that the contents of this bill were in other bills, and I discovered this after I scheduled the session today. Do you need this bill, or have you amended some of the contents of this bill into the and I'm forgetting the Senate bill number, 838 or
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckert. It is very similar to Senate Bill 812, which has moved out of another committee.
I was asked to introduce this bill. Another bill had been introduced unbeknownst to me. I checked with my client. They said, yeah, we'd like to go ahead with 820, so that's why we're here.
Okay. Can I, Mr. Chair, yes. Follow up on that?
Mm-hmm. Senator Starr.
Notwithstanding your client's wishes, does 812 accomplish the same results as moving 820? Does 812 accomplish the same results as 820?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, my understanding is they're very similar. So it has a very similar language, not identical, but similar.
Thank you.
Okay.
Does it accomplish the same thing?
Yeah.
I mean, we don't want to just move a bill. If
I will have to defer to Mr. Goddard on how much it accomplishes the same thing.
The provision, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the provisions of 820 are in Senate Bill 812.
Sorry. I think there are more sections in 812 than there are in 820. So 812 is actually a broader bill. 820 is a little more focused. And to the extent that they are the same, the individual changes are the same in each bill, but 812 has more of them. So they are different. So if 820 were to move forward, you would be accomplishing something different than if 812 moved forward. But if they both move forward, then they will conform with each other. Does that make sense? There may be 12 sections in 812. There are 8 sections in 820. So there are a few minor differences between the bills.
Mr. Chair, I'll be really blunt here. The plan for today was just to have a public hearing because my understanding was you didn't need this bill. I'm fine with the bill. I'm fine with, but I'm here. I heard just two different things just right there. So, I heard yes, it's the same bill, and then no, it's not. So I'm really a little under the weather and confused.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what I tried to say was the provisions in 820 are in 812. But my colleague from PG is correct that 812 includes additional items. It's broader. 812 is broader.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
And 812 is out of committee. What committee did it come through?
Senate Natural Resources and Environment.
And is it subsequently referred to this committee, or is it going to the floor?
To the floor.
Okay, well, I would suggest, Mr. Chair, that we hold this bill at this time. Sometimes when you pass two bills that do the same thing, there are conformity issues. And so if in fact, the guts of this bill are all included in 812, I would suggest we just hang on to this bill. Assuming 812 moves along, then it becomes the vehicle.
Yeah, and Mary, can you just hunt down
812
and... When I mean, these guys, but when the amendments were adopted, and that sounds great.
Yes, I did have a look at 812, Mr. Chair, and I did note on the dash 2 of 820 how the two bills differ. And just as a notation, I had thought there were a couple of policy issues I thought that you might want to be aware of. In section 8.3, I noticed that it removes the requirement that voters must approve the issuance of bonds if the proceeds will be used for the acquisition that pertains to a voluntary transaction in another entity. So under current law, all voters have to approve the issuance of bonds. But under the proposal, that's no longer the case in certain circumstances. It could be a voluntary transaction between the public people's utility district and another entity such as a cooperative, and that's a policy issue. The other thing that's interesting about the 820, which I call the dash two because it's incorporated elements of 812 that are very different from 820, is the whole topic of the renewable energy facilities and the renewable energy certificates. And if you look at the back page of the dash two, I gave you the last paragraph, rather, first paragraph highlights what a people's utility district is, but the last paragraph mainly talks about Oregon's policies encouraging electricity suppliers to offer green power options. And beginning in 2002, 1.2 million electricity customers gained three new green power options. For example, one option was that they could purchase wind energy that would cost them an additional, let's say, $3.50 per month more for each 100 kilowatt hour block of power that is consumed. The problem is, I think, that all electricity suppliers may not have direct access to the green power, and so something is born out of that called a sort of a certificate. It's a tradable entity. It's an intangible entity. So under current law, I'd have to ask the department, under current law, these intangible certificates would be exempt under the 820, but not particularly exempt under current law. I'd have to check that out.
If I could ask one of you gentlemen to step back. John, would you come on up? John,
please. Happy to.
Okay. Yeah, just one. John, come on up here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Phillips, the Department of Revenue. Do you want me to comment, or
yes,
would you like?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And we're trying to get our hands around this.
Okay. Mr. Chair, the only thing that stood out to us was Section 2. I have not read the Dash 2s completely. I just got them, as you probably did, so I really can't comment on the Dash 2s, and for that reason I reserve my comments on that. We were unclear as to the in the bill itself on page 1, section 2, subsection 2, line 22. A lot of twos in there, but this talks about this tax exempt status, and we looked at this, and our first impression was that the courts have already decided this issue in the current law, and it's not doesn't need legislative clarification.
Mm-hmm.
We went ahead and asked the Department of Justice for an opinion as to whether our thoughts on that were correct, and we may get them back this morning, but we haven't got them yet. So I don't know. There was a case in 98 called Western Generation where you have a EWEB, which is a non-taxable entity, a municipal governmental entity, that made an agreement and created this Western Generation entity in conjunction with CLATSA PUD, I understand. And is it Klatskanai or Klatsip?
Klatskanai,
excuse me. And so the part that was controlled by the PUD was determined to be taxable, and the part that was controlled by EWEB was not. And so I think that's what this says, but we're still awaiting some legal interpretation on that. And the rest of it, on the Dash 2s, I just don't know. I can't comment.
Mr. Chairman, it appears to me we have a truckload of questions on this one. So without objection, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 820. Mr. Chairman, are you well enough to take gavel, or is Senator Monroe?
I'll do it.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay, so we got 827 to go.
Yeah.
Open up public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 827.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 827 comes to you from the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, Workforce Development. And what the Senate bill attempts to do is establish and create a new revolving loan fund for the Urban Growth Boundary Expansion Area Revolving Loan Fund. And the fund is to provide low-interest loans for infrastructure projects in the urban growth boundary areas that newly expand. The need stems from that when the expansion of the urban growth boundaries occur, many times there isn't immediate funds or immediate cash flow funds to finance many of the infrastructure projects that are needed for that expansion. So this would provide, this fund would provide a no interest loans for these areas, for these loans also to be paid out of fees or taxes from that area itself. That's a requirement in the bill. And this loan is to be funded by $25 million as bonds coming from the Economic Development Fund that is the lottery amounts, lottery dollars. The one thing that I'm still looking at, Mr. Chair, is that there might be a slight slight problem or a slight difficulty with the loan fund being based on a bond from the lottery dollars, where you have the issue of the arbitrage with the federal federal bonding and laws requiring that there needs to be a distinct project for a loan, for a bond to be let to fund that loan and not bank the loan money in order to gain interest on it. So if that's, whether that is compatible within the process or not, I have not been able to establish that at this point. But
Mr. Chair.
Questions for staff? Senator Starr?
Yeah, that makes sense because, for lottery bonds, we let them, and then they have to go for specific program, specific project, and it has to be completed within a certain number of years, I think. I think it's a three-year time period.
Right.
So that would be an issue that we might have to address in this bill, because I don't think we're creating a new program that a lot of different cities could subscribe to, and we might need just a direct appropriation to create the fund rather than lottery-backed bonds.
Yeah. And the other question is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, I assume?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we've got some folks that want to be heard on this. Ron Papsdorf of City of Gresham and Linda Hunting of IOC. Welcome. Good to see you again. Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ron Papsdorf, representing the City of Gresham. I'm here to support Senate Bill 827. Senate Bill 827 really emerged out of some issues that the City of Gresham was facing, but many jurisdictions that have urban growth boundary expansion areas adjacent to them are facing. And that really is that local jurisdictions have a significant cash flow problem in terms of implementing urbanization of urban growth boundary expansion areas. We don't have a funding problem per se because as we develop the plans for urban growth boundary expansion areas in conjunction with property owners and the community and develop infrastructure plans for those areas, we also adopt funding mechanisms. And in the vast majority of cases, those are systems development charges to pay for infrastructure, and those are development fees assessed on new growth to pay for growth-related infrastructure to support that development. The problem is we don't collect those system development charges until development actually happens. And when you are talking about urban growth boundary expansion areas, these are rural areas with rural levels of infrastructure. Typically, they have no water system or sewer system. The roads were rural roads, not urban levels of infrastructure that are capable of supporting urban levels of development. So that means that you have to make a pretty significant investment in basic urban infrastructure before you can allow the first development to happen, far beyond, in most cases, the means of the first developer or first couple of developers to carry on their own just to get things started. But once we break that cash flow cycle, have a strategic investment in urban infrastructure for some key pieces to allow the first development phases to start, then we can collect the development fees from that development, repay those loans, and you've got a basic level of infrastructure that then can support further urban development. And we've really broken that major cash flow hurdle that we face. I want to give you an example of two urban growth boundary expansion areas just to kind of illustrate the problem here. We've had two significant expansions around the city of Gresham in the last 10 years. The first was 1,500 acres, an area to our southwest called Pleasant Valley. It was added to the urban growth boundary by Metro in 1998. It took a long time. It was really the first significant urban growth boundary expansion area in the metro area for a long time. And we worked really diligently with all of our regional partners and the community to come up with really an award-winning plan for that area. We've been working since the adoption of that plan with the community, and last year 540 acres of that area annexed into the city by petition. Property owners out there are ready to go. We've been working since that time to actually implement some development. Those property owners have an expectation, since the land was brought in almost 10 years ago now, that within a reasonable time frame they can actually develop that property. And we have this major funding difficulty to get some basic key infrastructure elements in place to support that urban development. In 2002, the urban growth boundary in the Portland area was expanded again. It was a very large boundary expansion. 1,500 acres of that expansion happened to our southeast and primarily in an industrial area called Springwater. US 26 runs directly through that area. Industrial development is even more difficult in these UGB expansion areas than residential. The market's quite different. The residential market, you may have some larger developers that have the capability to assemble properties, build some infrastructure, but when you're trying to recruit significant industrial development and employment development to industrial area, you're really typically dealing with one business, one development entity. It's harder to find a larger industrial developer that's going to assemble parcels of property and make a major investment in infrastructure initially to get that development going. So this is a really key tool to helping local governments break this cash flow issue and allow us to meet the obligations to actually implement urbanization of urban growth boundary expansion areas. This really is a strategically focused tool just at that unique aspect. Their local jurisdictions are facing a number of funding difficulties in urbanization and urban development generally, but this is a focused piece inside existing cities, existing urban growth boundaries that were in place before expansions happened, have different sets of difficulties, but generally local governments have some pools of built-up systems development charges in place to actually, and a certain level of urban infrastructure in place already to accommodate the development. So the difficulties are different. This bill did come out of Senator Metzger's Economic Development, Transportation, Workforce Development Committee unanimously. It's supported by the Special Districts Association, by the Home Builders Association, and by Thousand Friends of Oregon. And we do have a -3 amendment before the committee today as well that does one technical fix, refer you to the bill, page 2, subsection 5. There's starting on line 19, after the word municipality, it says that has expanded the urban growth boundary area since 1997. That time frame reference is laid out in subsection 4 above, and in many cases, the municipality that needs to build the infrastructure that's implementing the urban growth boundary development isn't the municipality that actually makes the decision to expand the urban growth boundary. So that just takes that piece out. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Are there questions for Mr. Krapsdorf? One of the, of course, you know that I was there in Metro when all this was happening, and one of the issues that we discussed was industrial lands and how the municipality will be able to protect industrial lands that are identified as industrial from residential encroachment, essentially, that there are always pressures when we identify and basically protect an area for industrial only. There are always pressures to to develop it for residential. Is that happening in Springwater?
Chair Mester, Senator Monroe, that's an excellent point. It absolutely is happening. Sorry. My apologies. We are facing that same problem. Because it takes longer generally for industrial development to start to happen, you've got property owners in Springwater. The urban growth boundary has been expanded. They want to realize urban development. The land values typically are slightly higher for residential development than for industrial development. And there's extreme pressure. Again, if you relate Pleasant Valley and Springwater, very close to each other, one primarily focused on residential development, one primarily focused on industrial development. And to the extent that we are slow or can't accommodate the planned urban residential development in Pleasant Valley, that just increases the pressure to put residential development on portions of Springwater. And we are seeing residential developers approach property owners in Springwater as well as the city about changing the plan, allowing residential development, and we continue to resist those efforts, point them to Pleasant Valley. The appropriate place is to do residential development. The industrial lands are flatter because that's the most appropriate land for industrial development. That also makes it easier and cheaper to do residential development. So the residential developers are drawn to those same areas as well. So those pressures do exist. We're experiencing them. We think ability to try to move urbanization and development of these areas is critical for relieving some of that pressure.
So then the question is, does this bill help you to resist the pressure to convert these lands that are set aside as industrial to residential?
Chair Decker, Senator Monroe, to the extent that it can help us achieve the residential development in the areas that it's appropriate to happen and where it's planned to happen, I do believe that it would help us take some pressure off the industrial properties. The flip side of that coin is, to the extent that we can use these resources to help make industrial land actually ready for industrial development, will then increase the market and our ability to recruit that industrial development. So those two things combined, I think, really do help get at that issue.
Well, thank you. And for maybe those of you that haven't dealt with this as much as I have, protecting industrial land for industrial needs is really critical, because otherwise you end up with just bedroom communities without any jobs. And so Metro, I know, is really, when they brought Springwater in at the request of the city of Gresham, it was specifically for industrial needs. And so anything we can do as a legislature, I think, to legally assist the city to protect that for industrial only, I think would be helpful. I am a little concerned about the questions that staff brought up in terms of whether or not this is legal under bonding laws. We'll have to look into that, or Ways and Means will have to look into that. Linda.
Hi, good morning. Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. The League does support S-Bill 827 and the amendment that Mr. Pavstor has brought forward today. We think the policy discussion is fairly self-evident and hope that the committee will see fit to move the bill onto Ways and Means. In terms of the policy, very quickly, I think you heard pretty much the gamut in the story from Mr. Pastors, but the areas that will likely accommodate our population influx and the required jobs that brings over the course of the next 15 years that we've seen forecasted will be looking to these areas inside the UGB. So anything that we can do to assist the planning and the infrastructure provision there is going to be extremely helpful. I know your folks in the land use committees have heard me talk about the need for infrastructure and the need for facilitating better tools for cities to be able to provide those services. The revolving loan process that we've seen in OECD's budget for the Special Public Works Fund and the Water Wastewater Fund, we've seen them demonstrate to work very, very well. Those funds are also They are funded by lottery bond allocations, same as this bill. So those funds work very, very well. You heard from Mr. Pashworth that this bill is very, very targeted, and to that end, we support the bill.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thank you very much. Is there anybody else that wanted to be heard on Senate Bill 827? Not seeing any. Yes, come on up.
Dennis Merlehill, Washington County. Washington County would support this. I think it's been hashed out quite a bit, so I'm not going to add anything more to it other than to say that the need is there.
Okay, other questions?
If anything else, it's too small of an amount.
Questions for Mr. Merlehill? He's running away, so I guess not.
I'll stay.
No, that's okay. Anybody else that wanted to be heard? Does Metro want to be heard on this measure?
I'll be just about as brief as Mr. Mulvihill there.
I'm Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. I've basically just been watching this bill and certainly applaud the creative effort to come up with a source of funding for the new UGB expansion areas that have been brought into the boundary over the last several years. Just in larger context, Metro is looking, and I testified to this effect when I testified on Senate Bill 1036 a couple of weeks ago. Metro is looking at overall regional funding shortfalls over the next several decades that include areas that have been brought to the boundary as well as areas that are inside the UGB already and that are going to require major infrastructure investments in order to be made ready for redevelopment if we're going to be able to accommodate the million people that are coming to the region over the next 25 years, or that we're told are coming to the region over the next 25 years. So this mechanism before you is part of a solution. I've certainly heard from some of my council who would love to see a mechanism like this that is also available for use within the existing urban growth boundary because of the infrastructure needs we have there. But that's just the only comment I have. Certainly think it's a good mechanism to use for supporting the growth that we're expecting in the region. So,
question for Mr. Tucker.
I thought you were going to be as brief as Dennis.
It's almost.
Thanks, Randy. Appreciate it. Okay, at this time we're going to close the public hearing on 827, open work session on 827. Senator Deckard.
I would move the dash three amendments to.
Senator Deckard has moved the dash three amendments. Is there discussion?
I don't have a copy of the dash three amendments.
Mr. Chair. Actually, yes. This dash three amendment is for the original bill, not the A and gross bill, so it doesn't work.
So it's not necessary?
Well, why don't we just move the bill down? You guys want to move the bill just down the Ways and Means?
Withdraw your motion, Senator Deckard.
Let's let Senator Starr.
I don't have a copy of the dash threes, but that's fine with me if we just move the bill.
And let him work here.
Yeah.
I withdraw my motion on the dash threes, Mr. Chair.
So ordered.
And move Senate Bill 827 to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, Senator Deckard has moved the A engrossed Senate Bill 827 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass, without recommendation. How do you want to do it?
Let's just send it to him.
Okay, without recommendation. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? So ordered. Are we done?
We're adjourned.
We're adjourned.